Okay, well, good morning. I'm going to give an overview of what I think we know about mass composition at high energies. I apologize to quite a number of the audience who've heard me give similar versions of this talk in the last couple of years, and in fact, there are write-ups of various conference talks on Astro pH. But the subject is evolving, so there'll be a few new things to say. Now, the key questions about ultra-high-energy cosmic rays have obviously been discussed earlier in the week, and they relate to the energy spectrum above 10 to the 18, the arrival direction distribution, and the mass composition. And really, the thesis of my talk is that unless we know the mass composition, we can't make much sense of interpreting the data at the highest energies, either of the spectrum or of the arrival directions. Now, this spectrum, which I think I stole from one of Tom's talks, of course, has accumulated over many years and always looks very, very nice when you plot it on this E squared, even on this E squared plot, over this many, many decades of intensity and of energy. And the point I want to emphasize is that even at LHC energies, and this is the energy which a proton would have hitting a stationary target to match the center of mass energy in the LHC. Even here at 10 to the 17, we are a factor of 300 away from the highest energies. So interpreting data, estimating energies from ground detectors is very fraught because one doesn't know the particle physics. And that's not really going to get very much better with the LHC. Because although the LHC, if you plot the number of charged particles as a function of rapidity that are expected, it seems to cover most of rapidity space. If you actually look at the energy that is carried by these particles as a function of rapidity, most of the energy is coming out in a part of rapidity which is not observed at the LHC, even with TOTEM and CMS. Now, things might get a bit better. There are plans for a detector very, very much in the forward direction to try and understand some particular production mechanisms of the Higgs. But I think in the near future, we're really blighted by the fact that we don't know what's going on at higher rapidities. And for extensive air showers, where what comes out of the collision carried by a small number of high-energy particles is important, that's a serious blow. Now, acceleration, I'm not going to say anything about because there were extensive talks about this, which unfortunately I missed earlier in the week, except to point out that the charge is crucial. Whether you have synchrotron acceleration, single shot acceleration, such as you might get in a pulsar, or diffusive shock acceleration, the charge always appears. So if you don't know the charge, it's difficult to be certain about the acceleration details. Now, there has, I think, been a fair degree of consensus amongst theorists that at the highest energy, protons dominate the ultra-high-energy cosmic rays. And in fact, the conclusion, the bottom line of my talk, is going to be that the evidence for protons is actually remarkably weak. And it could very well be that at the highest energies, a lot of the particles are heavy nuclei. However, if the particles are protons, they dominate and consequently acceleration becomes more difficult by a factor of Z, as I've just shown, and there are trans-GZK events, which I do believe, then one begins to talk about topological defects, cosmic strings and necklaces, decays of monopoles, perhaps manifestations of super-heavy relic particles decaying, other exotic physics like breakdown of Lorentz invariance. So all of these very exciting things, which have certainly attracted the attention of many theorists, are dependent on our understanding of the mass. Today, Stefan talked a little bit about the high-res Agassiz energy spectrum, and I was being critical of the plots and where the differential intensity is multiplied by the cube of the energy. This is the simple plot of the flux as a function of energy from 310 to the 18 up to beyond 10 to the 20. And you see that the differences don't look anything like as dramatic as they appear on the GAE cube plot. And in fact, it could be that shifting the energy of one or other of the experiments by something like 30% could actually reconcile them. There are also possibilities that there are difficulties in estimating the high-res aperture, particularly in the monomode. Stefan showed yesterday how with Auger it's possible to find the core with mono and also using the hybrid system. And of course the uncertainties in distance lead to uncertainties in energy estimates. So whether this difference between 11 and 2 events above 10 to the 20 is a real one or not may not just depend on energy calibration, it also might depend on technical details. And then at lower energies, the Agassiz aperture is an issue because they're actually at the threshold of the array and close to the threshold, it's actually quite difficult to define the aperture. I'll illustrate that in terms of some Auger estimates, where what I'm plotting here is the relative acceptance, flattening of course to 1, for charge produced by ion nuclei or charge produced by protons, and this is a function of the energy, and this is a linear scale along here. Don't worry about the details of the triggers, those are technical Auger details which you can skip. Notice this is for the winter, because it actually makes a difference to the detection of an event by the surface detector close to the threshold as to whether it's summer or winter, because this determines how far the particles spread out because of the Mollier unit. And notice that once one gets up above about 3 times 10 to the 18 electron volts, essentially the whole of the array is sensitive. But in the region close to the threshold, and this will be just as true for Agassiz as it is for Auger, there is quite a sensitivity to the mass and also a sensitivity to the season. So I'm not so worried about the differences at low energies here between the different experiments. I think in addition to the energy uncertainties, there's also uncertainties about the aperture, because you can see that this is approaching a factor of 2 in the flux and maybe a factor of 50 or 60% in the if you shift the energy. And that's pretty alarming, that the energy calibrations can be so far out, even at these quite modest energies of a few times 10 to the 18 electron volts. Now, I just want to point out a couple of things that are rather intriguing. In the fluorescence technique, what's wrong with the switch in this thing? In the fluorescence technique, what one measures from the integration under the longitudinal development curve is the calorimetric energy. And one has to add to that, to get the total energy E sub zero, what's often called the missing energy. And this missing energy arises because the muons and the neutrinos, which are still very much in the shower, and indeed some of the electrons themselves, bury themselves in the ground. And a correction has to be made because of that. This button seems to have given up. Correction has to be made because of that, but it's quite a small correction. And you can see at 10 to the 19 electron volts, for example, that it's 10% or so, and it's getting smaller as you go up in energy, and it has a weak dependence on the mass. This is for protons, and this is for iron. It's perhaps something like 5%. But I think what's interesting, and particularly in view of the conclusion I'm going to try and push you towards, is that the energy estimates made by the high-res group would be higher if iron was assumed by something like 5%. By contrast, the situation with the Agassiz experiment, where they measure this quantity S600, the signal in the scintillators at 600 meters from the axis, and use a model to convert to the energy, again as Stefan explained yesterday, You see, for different models, this is QGIS JET and SIBEL, there are 4% or 13%, depending on whether you assume protons or iron. And there are even differences between different implementations of the same models, but in different codes. And these work in the opposite direction. They actually work so that if AGASSA assumed that the particles were iron rather than protons, which is what they do assume, you would see smaller energies if iron were assumed in AGASSA. So the effect of the energy estimate, if iron is assumed, is to lower them in the case. I'm hoping this works. I only just bought it, spent 20 euros on this. I'll be taking it back next week. The interesting thing to me is that if one assumes iron, then the two spectra actually come closer together without making any assumptions about errors in calibration or aperture or anything. So it's a very, very interesting question. So to summarize, the way I see the situation with the energy spectrum at the moment is that there can be problems at low energies because of the apertures. At high energies, particularly the fluorescence apertures are uncertain. The surface detector apertures are not uncertain because essentially the arrays flatten. The model mass uncertainties in the conversion from SD are quite important. If you take an extreme case of iron in the QGIS JET model versus protons in SIBEL, then in the case of Ogier, there's a factor of nearly 60%, because in Ogier we measure the signal at 1,000 meters to relate to the energy, but we've got ways of getting around that, you'll be pleased to know. In AGASSA, it can be 15%. So there are big uncertainties because of model and because of mass, both of these. Fluorescence yield, as was mentioned yesterday, there's still an uncertainty of 20%, which is systematic. This is being worked on, and there's been a very successful run at SLAC, and also there's one underway at Argonne, led by Paolo Privatera from Ogier. And I think that will be resolved within the next couple of years. And indeed, the Ogier spectrum that will be reported in the summer, which is based on SD in terms of the statistics, will have its energy assessed from FD and essentially have no mass or model dependence, apart from the small dependence of a few percent that I measured. It will be dominated, in fact, by the systematic uncertainties in the fluorescence yield and, of course, by the statistical uncertainties. However, whatever is said in the summer by Ogier, I do think that events above 100 EEV do exist, and I just want to remind you of the three spectacular events: the AGASSA event of 230 EEV, which was published about 10 years ago now. It's very hard to see, even if you take a pessimistic view, if you want high energies, of the model and of the mass, that you can alter this by as much as a factor of 2. Equally, there is the famous high-res event, which has stood the test of time, and that the energy estimate seems to be robust at 3 times 10 to the 20. It's very hard to see how that's going to change. There is the so-called NSF event, which has never been included in any high-res spectrum, but was recorded apparently on a rather poor night, which had an hour or so in the middle that was very clear. And here you see the stereo data from the two high-res instruments agreeing almost unbelievably well at the 5% level in energy and in Xmax. That's a very, very convincing event and has not been withdrawn. You don't like my new you can't see it. Oh, sorry. Okay. Okay. Yeah, green is better, but you don't seem to be able to buy green in airports. Okay. So I think those three events, the AGASSA event, the Fly's Eye event, and the high-res event, tell you that these events exist above 10 to the 20 electron volts. The big issue is how many there are, and I think that's bound up with the issue of aperture, of mass, and of energy. So that brings me to the main subject of the talk, which is the question of mass composition. And I start with a quotation. We remain with the dilemma, protons versus heavy nuclei. Clear-cut decision cannot be reached yet. I believe that up to the highest energies, the protons are the most abundant in the cosmic rays. However, I must confess that a leak-proof test of the protonic nature of the primaries at the highest energies does not exist. It's a very important problem. Experimentally, it's quite a difficult problem. Well, that was written by Cocconi almost 50 years ago at the 5th International Cosmic Ray Conference. And it's as true today as it was then. He was probably talking about particles of 10 to the 19 electron volts, which were the high energies that were just beginning to be seen by experiments like at Agassiz and at Cornell. And probably very wisely, Cocconi abandoned the cosmic ray field about this time and went off to particle physics. I don't know how familiar you are with Latin, so I'll give you a translation of this nice term. Men wish to believe, I'm sure women as well, Glenys, only what they prefer. And I actually do think there's a little bit of prejudice, and I'll see some examples of this as I go through, in this idea that the highest energy cosmic rays are protons. Now, I want to start with some low energy data from the Cascada experiment in a very, very nice detailed paper that is just in press. Doesn't seem to be an isotope pH yet, but it's been through the refereeing procedure. And this shows the differential intensity multiplied by the energy to the 2.5 as a function of energy from 10 to the 15 to 10 to the 17. And this is the analysis done assuming the QGS Jet 01 version of the model, which is the latest available version of the QGS Jet model. And you see here that at these energies, 10 to the 16, 10 to the 15 to 10 to the 16, they argue that helium dominates over protons. Protons are red, helium's blue, carbon is the green. You see the break in the proton spectrum occurs well before the break in the helium spectrum. Interestingly, they find that with the QGS Jet model, there is hardly any iron in the 10 to the 16 to 10 to the 17 region. It's nearly all silicon. The iron and silicon appear at a few times 10 to the 16 eV. So there is mass, there's model dependence on the mass deduction. By contrast, if you go to Cybele 2.1, here you see that carbon are the most abundant nuclei at high energies, then helium, then protons. The knees are in the same relative positions in protons, helium, and carbon. And now the iron-silicon situation is reversed. There seems to be iron at all energies. The silicon appears to drop out at high energies. What? They're all experts. No, no, I'm sorry, yes. It's interpreting data. Yeah, sorry, I noticed that David had come in. I apologize. Yeah, this experiment is certainly, in my view, the best experiment that's been done in this energy range around the cosmic ray knee. And they make really very precise measurements of the number of electrons in charge and the number of muons. And they deconvolve the muon number, electron number plots using their models to extract the spectrum and the mass. And they use various techniques, three different techniques that are described in the paper, which I think has been done very carefully. Now, there is this uncertainty about the composition, but there's also an uncertainty about the position of the knee, which is dependent on the model. Notice QGS Jet 01, they estimate the knee in the all particle spectrum. This is summing up everything, so we're not worried about whether there's more carbon than helium or vice versa. And they don't actually find the break with any very great precision. On the other hand, the slopes before and after the knee are measured fairly independently. And I think this is a message which is useful for the higher energies, that although you might not get the features, such as the ankle or the break, terribly accurately, you probably get the slopes before and after these. And this energy is the thing that's very dependent on the assumptions deriving from the models. Now, if you want to know about the details of the difference between Sybil and QGIS Jet, Tom Geiser is one of the architects of the Sybil model. Essentially, for the purposes of this analysis, the difference in the muon production is what's important. The QGIS Jet model is more efficient in producing muon than the Sybil model. But I don't want to go into the details, particularly with Tom here.
It doesn't seem to be a contradiction between the two.
They are within the uncertainties, but I'm really pointing out that the uncertainties are pretty large. Yeah. But this is only at 10 to the 15, 10 to the 16. So what I'm really saying is if we can't be terribly positive about our conclusions in the knee, and this is a problem that's been worked on cosmic rays for 50 years, then we have to be a little cautious, is what we say at the very high energies.
Yeah, but we're just trying to understand whether there is a discrepancy between models or whether there is an uncertainty that the various models are actually in agreement, but there is a big uncertainty involved. This seems to be the case here.
Sorry. I don't think the models are in agreement at all. And I think if you look at this picture, where you have, as a result of the deconvolution, the carbon dominating over the helium, whereas that's with Sybil, with QGIS Jet, you have the helium dominating over the carbon. But essentially, what this is, the reason this arises. Well, I mean, I don't. The paper is quite a long, detailed paper. You know, this is figure 14 or something. So you need to read the paper to go into that. But the point really is that I think the difference arises because the difference in the number of muons predicted. And this is a point I will keep coming back to. If, since the QGIS Jet model is rather efficient in producing muons, you can explain the muon signal in the shards with a lighter mass than in the case of Sybil, where to get the same intensity of muons, you have to go to a heavier particle. So the models are essential in interpreting the observations on the muons. And that's the way it goes. It's the break for all the particles added up together, yes. Yeah. That's not too uncertain. And indeed, the break, if you look here at protons, the break is about 2, 3, 4, 5, 10 to the 15, sorry. Whereas here, it's slightly higher in energy with QGIS Jet. No, I'm not going to talk about it in that term. I just want to explain, when I come to the ultra-high energies, and you theorists are going to be upset that you're going to have to try and explain everything with a lot of iron there. I'm telling you that the problem is not just something that exists at high energies, there are problems at low energies as well, because we don't know the particle physics. Yeah, I'll give you some numbers on that later. We don't know. There's a new model of QGIS Jet coming out, which is said to be producing fewer muons, which in this term would make you need heavier particles, but that model is not yet available. I should say at this point, I think what the Sybil authors and the QGIS Jet authors have done in making their models available to the whole community is tremendous, because they've been, over the many decades in this field, there has been immense confusion because people have used their own local model. But at least we're now down to two models. The models may not be right. And in fact, I'm quite unpopular within the Ogier collaboration because I go around and saying, look, we've no idea what the systematic uncertainty in the models is. It could be anything. 10 to the 20, for all we know, maybe lots of the particle energy goes into neutrinos. So the systematic is inherently unknowable. It may be 20% in the fluorescence yield, which is quite a big systematic uncertainty, as somebody was commenting on yesterday. But in the models, we just don't know what the systematics are. And they lead to quite contrary predictions on the relative components of carbon, helium, and iron. I mean, forget about the silicon, iron stuff. There just may be too many species present. But I think down at the the lighter masses, this is reasonable. Sorry, Glennis.
I just wanted to add a remark that there's yet another, I think, really, really profound and important, and certainly this is important. All of these models assume that what is reasonable assumptions are not guaranteed, that you don't have to do with what happens after the fluid. There's two ways in which it to determine. One, if you have a heavy nuclear,
No, you make an important point. What we know, I was emphasizing how little we knew about the distribution of energy as a function of rapidity, and will even from the LHC. For proton-nucleus collisions, we have to make extrapolation. Nucleus-nucleus collisions, we have to make extrapolations. And pion-nucleus collisions, we don't know very much about those either. So the message is the models are not very certain. However, I just wanted to show, Oh, yes, I agree. I don't want to discuss that because the theme of the workshop is ultra-high-energy cosmic rays. I only decided last night to put this in just to illustrate that things are not clean at all at 10 to the 15 electron volt. I think there is one in the paper, but I wasn't planning to give a review of mass over the whole wave. What I will show, what is here from the paper, the results of the proton energy spectrum. And this, I think, is pretty impressive, the agreement over this range. And you see, it begins to get worse when you run into compare the Ayrshire experiment, the Debeck experiment, with the Runjob experiment or JC, which are where you begin to run out of statistics by looking at the cosmic rays directly. JC and Runjob are based on long balloon flights. Here, but be careful, this is multiplied by e to the 2.7, you see the difference between the result with Sybil and the result with QGS Jet. What I think is fantastic about this as an experimentalist is these stars here are from the Ryan Orms and I think Willis Abramarian experiment of 1972. So they really fit very, very nicely. So the message I would like to also get across is I think actually the experimental data is pretty damn good in a lot of cases. It's understanding it that's hard. Now what we do in trying to get mass at higher energies is use a battery of techniques. The strongly favored one is X-max and fluctuations in X-max. The muon content of Schar's, which is essentially the technique that was used in the gas experiment, lateral distributions, time spread, comparison of rates at different angles, and then comparison of X-max with photon predictions. And I'm going to go through these and point out that except for N mu, this one here, all of these techniques can be used with Auger. Now, turning to X-max, these are the latest high-res results. And what's plotted here is the depth of maximum in grams per square centimeter as a function of energy. This is 10 to the 18, 10 to the 20. I'll say something about this region later on, because I don't fully understand what's going on here. But note the experimental data, which is from about 500 stereo events. And there should be more reported, I guess, at the ICRC. Notice the comparison is the conclusion you draw about the mass is dependent on which model you use. If you use QGS jet, then the primaries at the higher energies look fairly light. This goes up to about 3×10⁻¹. But if the primaries really are Sybil, if Sybil really describes the behavior of the primaries, then you would need to have a mixture of masses. The data are the triangles with the uncertainties on them. Open circles are Sybil, yeah, and the squares are the QGS jet. Now, of course, it could be that everything is, let's say, carbon. That might fit that X-max very well, but it's much more probable, I would argue, that there will be a mixture of species. And what's normally done to try and resolve that is to compare the spread, which is shown by the data here in the solid lines, against the models. Here, the models are calculated for protons. There's actually very little difference between QGS jet and Sybil in terms of the fluctuations. Here we have the fit for iron, and it's argued that you can explain the data with a mass composition that is dominated but not entirely composed of protons. And what you actually deduce from this depends on the assumptions of the models rather in some detail. The conclusion in the high-res paper, this is actually taken from the 03 paper, I was lazy and didn't take the picture from the most recent publication, but essentially it's not changed. The conclusion is, which comes really from the tail of this X-max distribution here that you see in the solid line, this is produced by protons. But it's actually quite difficult to be sure of that because of instrumental effects. And one of the instrumental effects arises because of the diurnal and seasonal changes, which may be very important. And we've studied this quite a lot at the Malargwe site, where in this paper, the atmospheric profile as a function of time of day, time of year, has been explored by launching balloons. These balloons are set up periodically, and they measure the temperature and pressure as a function of height. The balloon gets up to about 20 kilometers when it bursts. One of the things you get to do as spokesperson is the fun of launching balloons in the Pampa. And the problem is that if you don't have a good understanding of the profile of the atmosphere, then interpreting these kind of longitudinal development curves, which come from the stereo high-res, and really being sure that you understand the tails of the distributions of X-max, so that in this kind of picture, you can be confident that the spread that you're seeing here is actually due, and the tail is actually due to the presence of protons rather than some instrumental effect. In my view, that still has to be proved, and I can see from where we are with understanding the Auger data, it's going to be a pretty tough job doing that in a convincing way. I'm not so sure that that's proven. There's certainly a lot less cloud. But I think the variations of the atmosphere from night to night and seasonal will not be that dissimilar. You can still, it's not a question of how clear the sky is. It's a question of the distribution of the layers that's important.
And from my understanding was that because of the different location of the atmosphere, that the atmospheric conditions in and so much less variation.
Yeah, that's possibly true at close to the ground, but I'm not sure that that's true at high altitude. Stefan, would you like to comment on that? Well, I mean, I think you have to be a little bit careful. I remember there's obviously a lot of politics going on in this. Not to put too fine a point on it. And it is true that in terms of the number of Rayleigh nights, Utah is a better site than Malargwe. But from the point of view of the purpose of the FD at Auger, that's not a serious handicap, because what we want to use the FD for is a calibration. What I'm arguing here is that to understand the uncertainties in Xmax, you need to understand the temperature and pressure distribution. But
And my impression from the videos that they showed was that the temperature profile of the atmosphere is very stable in Utah. More temperature than ours is maybe the...
I'm not sure that I've seen any temperature profiles from... There is some analysis along those lines. I'll not get this the right way around, but the changes summer to winter are such that a proton in the winter looks like an iron nucleus in the summer, or the other way around. I never remember which way it is. And I don't want to try and think it through in public. It would be embarrassing. Okay, so all I want to say is that I think one has to be, at this stage, a little bit cautious in interpreting the width and the tail of this Xmax distribution in terms of lots of light nuclei. That's not to say that's not the way it will turn out, but I'm not convinced yet. Okay, well, what I want to turn to now is, in a sense, the classical method of getting at the mass composition, which is to measure the muon content. And this method has been around in the cosmic ray field probably for 50 years. People recognized early on that through this analysis, which I won't step through, you would expect to have more muons in an iron shower. And the difficulty in making this measurement, and how many more muons you get, again, we'll see in a moment, is that the muons comprise only about 10% of the total number of particles in the shower. And you need to be quite rich to measure these effectively. And it's been used very successfully at lower energies by Cascada, in the data that I've talked about. At high energies, it becomes even more expensive because you have to cover large detectors with some sort of absorber or bury them. And it's really only been done at Yakutsk and at Agassa. And in both experiments, the muon density has been measured at a kilometer or reduced at a kilometer. The Agassa data is based on 129 events above 10 to the 19. And those are shown here by the open circles. This is just the log of the muon density as a function of energy. The black lines correspond to the predictions for photons, assuming that there's nothing weird happens to the photon pion production cross-section at high energies. What I want to emphasize is the relatively small differences between the protons, which are the blue lines, and the iron nuclei, which are the red lines. This is calculated with QGS jet. The statement in the Agassa paper is that this is consistent with a proton dominant component. I don't find that personally to be terribly compelling, but that's what they say. And in fact, in a later plot that I'll show when I summarize everything, we'll see that they choose to reduce upper limits to the iron fraction. But I just want to emphasize again this business of the models. Sybil, as QGS Jet, has evolved through various stages, just that the Sybil people have published their data in a more convenient form. And if you compare these three models, and the ratio of muon numbers is 1 to 1.17 to 1.45, so there's a 24% difference here. Although the QGS Jet 01 and the later QGS Jet are more like Sybil. But the point I want to emphasize is that if you move from QGS jet to Sybil, what happens is that these lines, the dotted lines for iron and for protons, actually move down in the diagram. So you expect the estimates of the mass to be higher with the Sybil model or with the later QGS jet model. And I just reiterate the problem that we don't really know what's going on because we're so far beyond LHC energies. Now these are the pairs I think they're plus or minus one sigma. So they're not very well separated. The resolution is very poor. I mean, the means differ by something like 30%, but the actual spreads are quite wide. And of course, this hasn't taken into account all the points that Glenys was making. The solid, that's the prediction for photons, yeah. They would be inside this region, and if there was lots of photons there, you would expect some scattering. I'll say something about the photon situation towards the end. This is the same thing, same kind of plot, but not conveniently in colors. The dashed line here and here are for R nuclei. This is from Yakutsk. The dotted lines are for protons. Their energy threshold is higher. It's one GeV as opposed to about half a GeV. So there are rather fewer muons, but they have some large area muon detectors. Photons are this black line and the red line. Now, you might be convinced that down here there are muon signals that seem more consistent with the lighter nuclei than the heavier nuclei. But I think what's interesting in these highest energy points, the three highest energy points, which are claimed to be above 10 to the 20, and that's by no means certain, they clearly don't favor light nuclei as opposed to heavy nuclei. You can't tell what the mass composition is clearly with three events. All I'm really saying is that it's not something you should bet strongly on, that from those data they are protons.
I'm not completely convinced by this plot. It's very difficult to judge. It's good that you have a small shift between the models of iron and water. But when you have a very large number of events, if you look at averages, the signal might be very small. It's very difficult to judge by eye whether or not the data are consistent or inconsistent with one or the other. And even though you have a large spread, a systematic shift in the average doesn't. To me, it doesn't seem that it's impossible to interpret the data. You may argue that different models give you the shift, but just based on the statistical situation, it's not clear to me that you think that it's
well. I mean, this, as I said, this particular one by eye, I think. Well, it's hard here because there's so many points. The green, I think, are quite well resolved by individual events, and I would not disagree that this might be consistent with light. Really wanting to draw attention to the highest energy events here, it's very hard to tell. And whether you take the average or the spread, I don't think you can tell. The statistics are really too poor. Muons are a tough way to go because of the expense. Oh, sorry, that's muon density, rho sub mu. The same. It's exactly the same as here. It's just that the Russians have used a particular notation. So, it does. Yeah, no, it should be. It should be. Sorry, I missed that. Yeah, it's per square meter, of course. Yeah. Okay, so that's the muon technique, and I mean, for my money, it's a tough technique. It's very, very dependent on the models, and it's hard to see how one would do this in a cost-effective manner at energies above 10 to the 19. It's also not a technique that we're planning to use at Auger immediately. We may be able to use it with inclined showers in the future when we understand inclined showers rather better. Now, another way of getting at the mass is to use the lateral distribution. The lateral distribution is the term we use to describe the fall off of the signal as a function of distance. And I think the first thing I would emphasize here is that this next sequence of slides illustrates how important it is to have, first of all, good data, and then to review those data with different models. These are some data from the Havre Park experiment, which were taken in the late 70s. This is a 500 meter spacing, and we infilled with detectors of 1 square meter on roughly a 150 meter grid so that we could measure the lateral distribution rather accurately. And this is an average. And this is a prediction, I think again, Tongaza was involved in this prediction, made in 1978 when Feynman scaling was the best buy. If you went to your friendly particle physicists and asked what to use, then they would say, oh yes, you've got to use Feynman scaling. Well, that looks really pretty awful. And in fact, you wonder if to fit the data, you might not be better off with primary uranium than iron or gold or protons. But life moves on. Different models come into fashion. Unfortunately, this is a slightly different plot because by this time I'd found a way to linearize this kind of plot. These are individual events. The green points are the experimental data from a proton with this parameter eta, which describes the steepness of 2.48. Iron these are predictions for different etas. The experimental data for a particular event are the blue points in the middle. And you see that this for this particular event, it lies in between. However, we were able to measure, because of the small spacing of the experiment, we were able to measure this parameter eta and compare the spread in this with what you get from models.
What is
the y-axis? The y-axis is the distance from the core. The y-axis is the density multiplied by r to the quantity eta, r to the power of r over 400 meters. It was a nasty function that we chose to describe the data. I can't even remember how I got this, but it was r to the minus eta plus r over 4,000. And that's r is in meters. And that function, if you plot it, the signal multiplied by r to the power of r over 400, then the slope of that is just eta. But I hadn't worked that out in the previous picture. Here the uncertainty in R is very small. It was substantially less than 10 meters. But it's a fair... Well, if you go through the algebra, I haven't done it for 30 years, but it's or 20 years, but it's pretty trivial. Okay, what you can then do is compare this kind of plot as a function of the expectation from the models and solve for the mass. Actually, for some reason I haven't got the raw data there, you'll just have to believe me, that you can get the fraction of protons, and the dotted line here is what you get with the QGS Jet 98 version. The solid line, which unfortunately became available just after we had written the paper, basically, and done all the calculations, is what you get from the QGS Jet 01. And you see that the shift is comparable to the statistical uncertainty. So we're at a state here between few 10 to the 17 and few 10 to the 18, where the uncertainties in the data are comparable to the uncertainties in the model. Don't worry about these points here. There's a well-understood trigger bias. And what we conclude from this is that there is a significant fraction of considerable evidence of a mixture of protons and ion nuclei there. Yeah, in fact, we tried carbon as well, and it made very little difference. Now, I did the same thing with the La Plata group, with Terry Dover's group, using the Volcano Ranch data. John Lindsley had given us permission to do this shortly before he died. Here you see very clearly the prediction. This parameter eta is slightly different from the Havre Park one, but it doesn't matter. Here you see the fit to the experimental data is much better if you assume iron rather than protons. Unfortunately, what John didn't leave behind was the energies of these individual events. So the conclusion from the lateral distribution is that around about 10 to the 18 electron volts, there's quite a lot of iron and protons. Now, another parameter you can use is the thickness of the shard disk. And as much as anything, this result was the one that made me change my thinking, because I was as prejudiced as Kokoni about protons at high energies. But these were data from Havre Park, so I couldn't ignore them. And this was at around about 10 to the 19 electron volts. And basically what measures the thickness of the shard disk, these are shown by the filled points here. We were expecting to see some asymmetry. This angle zeta depends on how much attenuation there is of the shard as it goes through the atmosphere, because at larger angles, as the shard comes through the atmosphere, the detectors that it hits first, even if they are the same distance from the core, compared with the detectors that hit later, there is some absorption as you cross through the atmosphere. Depends on the size of the array. And we just didn't have the statistics really to see this, so we haven't done other than publish this in the ICRC, and we probably won't now because there will be better, much, much better Auger data coming soon. The situation is that experimental data for the average gives 184 nanoseconds, protons 226, iron 196. Now, I really believe that difference. And although it does depend on models, it was the thing that really triggered me, so it's perhaps more of a sociological interest than anything else. That's just the fit. And then this is an attempt to summarize what I've said. These are the lateral distribution data from Havre Park. This is a Volcano Ranch measurement. This is the Havre Park rise time measurement. I've put a downward arrow there because I'm not terribly confident of this. The muon data from Akeno, this A1 here, and from Agassa, the red points, I think should be shoved up in terms of the iron fraction. The data shouldn't change. I think the data are okay. The point is the interpretation should push these up as the models change. And what one's left with is a problem, really, with the high-res data, because I don't see that the models are going to change the high-res data. As we saw in the fluctuations of Xmax, these are rather the interpretation is rather independent of the models. But, as I said, I have some doubts about how well one can understand the atmosphere, either in Auger or in high-res. But notice here the inbuilt prejudice of the Agassa people. They show this as upper limits. But I think in terms of the data that I showed you, that's going to be hard to believe. Now, just a word about the high-res data. Oh, sorry, my conclusion is that a lot of heavy nuclei above 10 to the 19 is a possibility. I just want to say a word about the Xmax against energy, the low energy part of this, the Xmax plot that I showed earlier. These are the data from two papers published by the high-res group. And this is the so-called high-res MIA comparison, where data were used to find the core from the shard array. And you see the depth of maximum changing, apparently in a very different way from the changes expected from our composition, which doesn't depend on energy. And the argument of the high-res group is that this shows evidence of changing from heavy nuclei to lighter nuclei. The problem I have is that in the same two papers, that was figure one, this is figure two, they show the data for the muon signal at 600 meters, because these are lower energy events from 10 to the 17 to 10 to the 18. The data are the shaded area where systematic and statistical uncertainties are combined. The top plot is QGS iron, the bottom plot is QGS protons. And I have to say, it seems to me that this is rather consistent with iron. I gather there was quite a battle went on within the collaboration over the statement in the paper that the conclusion was that they were changing from iron to protons. Well, I wouldn't want to discuss that political issue. Yeah, it's a paper Jim won't talk about. But it was a high-res prototype. I did check that you weren't on it, Stefan, or I would have asked you to comment. Right, I just wanted to mention a technique that Stefan referred to yesterday, which was a technique that was introduced by the San Diego-Leeds collaboration a year or two ago. And this is to try and get the mass information from the study of inclined shards. I'm conscious that I'm running out of time, but there have been a lot of interruptions, so I'm going to go on until I finish. The idea here is that sooner or later we will know the spectrum from the fluorescence detector, independent of the mass and independent of the models, except at the sort of 5% level. When we do that, we can then inject that spectrum at large angles and compare what we see on the detectors in terms of rate with what we predict for photons, for protons, for ion nuclei, and in principle in neutrinos, as was explained. So the input is the mass-independent spectrum, the output is the predicted spectrum, and we compare the measured rates. And this, as Stefan mentioned yesterday, was developed with Hubbard Park data. You have to worry at these large angles with the about the geomagnetic field. There was a very nice piece of work done by these people showing that you could model the magnetic field analytically, and this is a comparison of the spread of muons on the ground. This is 4 kilometers by 4 kilometers for an event at about 80 degrees, and you see these nice symmetric patterns, but obviously not circular patterns, and this is what you get from models. And of course, it's very, very powerful to be able to use this analytical tool rather than have to do model calculations for every energy and every mass, because these calculations take a lot of time. This is just a fit of one of those sets of data to a Havre Park event. This was actually one that was recorded with the infill array, which is all those yellow points there. So there's a mass of data, and you can make the fit rather well. This was an event of 6 × 10⁻¹⁹ at 74 degrees. I'm sorry the uncertainties aren't included on the energy there. That's probably been overtaken by events. Now, what we were really interested in doing was seeing whether the rate was consistent with photons or with nucleonic primaries. At the time, I'd just been writing a review article with Nagano, so there was a sort of composite spectrum there, NW spectrum. That spectrum actually is rather high compared with what I think would be the better spectrum at the higher energies now. And nonetheless, the experimental data, and this is an integral plot, unfortunately, the experimental data, which are the points with uncertainties, do seem to fit protons rather better than iron. If you use the lower spectrum, you probably need to have heavier nuclei there. The real point that we were trying to get at in this paper is that the prediction of the flux for photons did not agree with the observations. This was using a bunch of events between 60 and 80 degrees. There were some 52 events or something. The same conclusion comes from the Agassiz muon Poor events, and the limits of 40% are very similar in the difference experiments. Now, unfortunately, having got that result and thinking it was going to knock lots of models on the head, some of these top-down models, the theorists decided that the superheavy relic particles fragmented in a rather different way, and really we had to do this work at 10 to the 20 where we didn't have any data. However, I think it is worth noting that we do not know the flux of photons, and there could be quite a lot of photons there, and that could have quite big impacts on conclusions. Now, there have been efforts to do this, this is work from the Auger group, but it's far from the result yet. We will report the photon limit in the summer. Really, what's been done here is very similar to what was done by Francis and colleagues about 10 years ago now, comparing the fly's eye result. And this is just an individual Auger event at about 5 × 10⁻¹⁹. The depth maximum is about 800 grams, and this is what you get from photon simulations. And we are doing an analysis, and as I say, we'll report it in the summer, to get the photon limit. But we're not going to get down, I'm pretty sure, and I don't think it's telling any secrets, we're not going to get down much below around 10%, and at 10 to the 20 electron volts will be a way off that for some time. Now, of course, these ideas are important. The whole issue of photons are important in the context of the superheavy relics from the early universe, the so-called Wuchzillers, Kryptons, and Bortons. As I mentioned, theorists have moved their models, and of course then you can start to talk about the breakdown of the Lorentz invariance and all these other exotics. But what I've really been trying to say for the last hour is maybe it's relatively simple. The ultra-high energy cosmic rays could have a lot of iron nuclei there, or there could conceivably be a lot of iron nuclei accelerated at the source, and propagation that will change. Of course, the magnetic fields are not really well known either in interstellar space or in the source. So what would the consequences be of fewer protons? Well, first of all, it would make acceleration z times easier, which is quite a bonus. Isotropy would be easier to understand. Of course, it doesn't rule out any of the ideas that Glenys will possibly be talking about, I guess, this afternoon, about clustering. There would, as I said at the beginning, be some reconciliation between the GASA and the high-res spectra. There'll be less need for exotic physics, so that's not quite as exciting. But in some ways, perhaps there's even more of a puzzle to think of a source that produces iron, because it's always said to be fragile. Nonetheless, I have sufficient confidence in the theorists worldwide, not just those in this room, that if I was to come along with a bunch of nuclei at 10 to the 20 and say, these really are iron, go away and find out how they were made, it would not be too long before there were a few tens of papers on AstroPH saying how to do it. There's another comment that I want to make just to finish. I will only be very brief on this because I'm sure Angela Linter will talk about this next week. And that is that if you change from protons at high energies to iron nuclei at high energies, and here we've made assumptions based on Ellie's ideas of astrophysical and cosmological parameters, then there are quite significant changes in the fraction of fraction of neutrinos. The left-hand side shows the prediction of the neutrino flux for proton primaries, the right-hand side for iron. The solid line is the Waxman-Bacall bound, which of course assumes protons. And it's interesting that from propagation, essentially propagation effects, which give you neutrinos from neutron decay or from pions, as illustrated here, you actually can get quite close to the Waxman-Bacall bound. With iron, the situation is different. You get a lot more neutrinos predicted at about 10 to the 15 electron volts than you do here, and you don't approach the Waxman-Bacall bound for protons in the same way. So there are quite significant consequences, but as I say, I think Angela will have more to say about that next week. So let me end by just reminding you about the potential of the Auger Observatory. We'll measure the directions extremely well. I think we'll measure the energy very well, and as I've said, we will report a spectrum based on surface detector statistics, but without making assumptions about mass and models this summer. Mass is going to be harder. Photons, I think, will be relatively easy. There's depth of maximum, Schar front thickness, inclined events, as I've tried to explain. Neutrinos, if there are any, as Stefan explained yesterday, yeah, that we'll see neutrinos. But are there any to see? Protons or iron, as I've illustrated, are much harder. But we have all these tools, depth of maximum, lateral distribution, width of the shower, inclined events, radius of curvature, things that we probably haven't thought of yet, which will allow us to get at the mass, I hope, of the nucleonic component at the highest energies. Thanks very much. Or is it simple? No. I'm just saying that you need, if you have these super heavy relic particles, when these fragment, you expect to get a lot of photons, a lot of neutrinos, and not too many protons. So the prediction of the super heavy relic models are that you'll see a lot of photons. What I'm saying is that instead of having these super heavy relic models and having a lot of photons, maybe it's a simpler explanation. Yeah. And basically, as I said at the beginning, the message that I've been trying to sell for the last couple of years is that I don't think the evidence for protons, when you look at it in detail is as strong as justifies many theoretical papers that start. It is well known that above 10 to the 19 eV, all of the particles are protons. Well, the sky, as I think Stefan Westerhoff will have shown on Tuesday, is really very isotropic. There may be these clusters, but the bulk of the cosmic rays, above 10 to the 19, come pretty uniformly across the sky. And that is actually quite hard to... It's easier to explain that with our nuclei, because they're going to be more bent in the magnetic fields. Well, as you go to higher and higher energies, it becomes harder to explain with protons, right. depending on whether there's a GZK cut or not.
Yeah, but even if you take a more larger structure, with no problem. With the current number of events.
With the current, no, I'm anticipating that we will have the sort of events. Yeah. Yeah, that's why I said, the magnetic field strengths really well known? There are two possibilities. And that, of course, if the fields are stronger in the sources, then the acceleration problem is alleviated. At 10 to the 18, you weren't here yesterday, but Stefan showed the prospects with Auger for seeing the cosmogenic neutrinos from the neon and electron cosmogenic neutrinos are very, very poor, unless something strange happens to the cross-section. We should be able to see the tau neutrinos, yeah. But tau neutrinos we should be able to see, but of course the tau neutrinos would suffer the same fate as here, because the energies are not so high. The energies basically are ending up in these low energy things for you to look at, except it's pretty miserable for you as well. You've really got to see you've got to see Ellie's neutrinos.
You know, I saw them, but I never saw them at the actual rate, but then I saw the
floor. It is bad news. So on the other hand, if your goal, and I think one of my goals is to try and find out about the mass, if we don't see this small handful of tau neutrinos that we're expecting to see, that will be a very interesting result too. But that really is probably 5 years away, because we need the exposure, we really need to understand the horizontal events and the reconstruction. But there's an awful lot to do on that problem.
Thank you.